This is Corolla Digital. This is Reasonable Doubt with your hosts, Mark Garagus and Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but to get on. Many get on. Welcome to the best hour or thereabouts in the universe. It is Reasonable Doubt. I'm Adam Carolla. Mark Garagus over there, but where is Mark Garagus?
Today I'm in Rhode Island. By the time you listen to this, I'll be in downtown Los Angeles.
So, traveling around, saving the world.
Traveling around. Where are you going, by the way? When we're listening to this, you will be smack dab one third of the way into the long weekend. Where are you going to be?
I am going to Indianapolis for the race. I am going to premiere Uppity, my latest documentary. That'll be tonight, as you listen to this, in Indianapolis Museum of Arts, Tobias Theater. So that will be a free screening, and I'll be there with Willie T. Ribbs himself doing a Q&A afterward.
Rumor has it that documentary and story may have some legs, but we're not allowed to talk about that yet, are we?
No, or I don't know, but there's been some multiple entities, some known well to Mark Garagus, others unknown to Mark, that have actually taken the story of the doc and thought this might have legs for a feature or even a series. And, you know, why shouldn't it? It's a story that nobody knows about, you know, sort of the Jackie Robinson of race car driving.
It's amazing. It's an amazing story. Do you know what's even more amazing as we're speaking is that we're taping this early in the week so that everybody can listen, but I think as we speak, Gary can confirm for me that Michael Cohen's business partner in the taxi cab company that we've talked about just pled guilty to tax evasion in state court of New York. So I'd like to unpack that for a second. Did I get that right, Gary?
And yes, you did. It is name. Yes, you did. It is unfolding as we speak. His name is, and I forgive me if I butcher this, but Evgeny Friedman.
All right.
Who's apparently connected to the taxi cab company. So now, we've mentioned before, we're kind of leading with this weekend, Russia run amok. We talked before about the kind of chess moves of having the state involved because the fear of, and by the investigators at least, the fear that if Trump were to pardon Cohen, that therefore that he would effectively nail Mueller's investigation right in the middle of not getting anywhere. So this now portends to me that the business partner pleads in state court. So when the president pardon somebody, he can only pardon for a federal offense. He could not pardon his way out of a state court offense. And so that is the kind of move when you think that potentially the president could pardon his way out of it.
So it's a kind of move that the partner makes, or the kind of move that the feds make?
The move that the feds make in conjunction with the state authorities. In this case, the New York Attorney General's office, who lost their top lawyer. Remember that story?
Sure. He was a real champion for women's rights. He loved the ladies.
Did you talk about that on the big show?
We talked a little bit. I don't know why there's nothing more satisfying than hypocrisy coming home to roost, you know? And I saw a tweet of his. And when I hit the tweet that had the picture that he had on his tweet was his home base tweet picture, which everyone, I don't know all the lingo, but the point is it was him as the tip of the spear with like a black woman and a white woman and an Asian woman and a middle-aged woman and a young woman. And they're all holding signs saying justice and me too.
It was his little brown slave or whatever.
Right.
His nickname for her was.
The second I saw it, I was like, oh, I got to show this on the podcast. And he immediately removed the whole thing. And that's what happened. But I do enjoy I do enjoy all the crazed hypocrisy. But now he's gone.
And you do it from a different standpoint than I do. I was remarking to somebody over the weekend that there is so much here in terms of, I never thought in my lifetime I would see it. Republicans now are the party of the criminal defense lawyer. Everything that they're saying is what I've been saying for 25, 30 years. With prosecutors running amok, having agendas, this idea that when you talk about them in exalted or, terms, and that you're somehow, that they're there. You know, it's always, I can't tell you how many trials I've had where the prosecutor gets up and says something about, oh, well, I'm just here. I represent the people. And my response is, yeah, I represent the people too, one at a time. Right. And you're not representing the people. And, it might say to arrest or to protect and serve, but really your job is to arrest and convict. And so there is something gratifying for me personally. As much as you love the hypocrisy, I love the fact that the people that they got in bed with have now turned on them, and to some degree rightfully so. It was everything that we complained about back in the 90s, and now the chickens are coming home to roost, as they say.
Well, so Cohen's partner, having it done at the state level versus the federal level, says what to you again?
Well, doing it at the state level for a tax filing, I mean, you can go either way. If there's a tax filing on the state side, generally you can gin that up into a federal tax violation as well. By doing it on the state side, if Trump were to pardon Cohen going forward, say 4 months from now, let me play it out. This guy, whatever his name is, he decides he needs some cooperation with the attorney general so he doesn't go to jail. And so he starts squealing on Cohen. And so to put the pressure on Cohen so that they work up the food chain, which is how the feds and traditionally for the last 50 years have worked. And basically, this is an outgrowth of the sentencing guidelines. And when the sentencing guidelines were enacted, which was supposed to eliminate disparity in sentences, so if I got busted for one thing and prosecuted in New York, I'm not going to get a markedly different sentence than I got in Iowa or something like that. What ended up happening is that prosecutors would load up charges so that they could manipulate the sentence, basically, and it kind of stripped the judges of their sentencing authority. Now, so what happens is, and that also, the added kind of unintended consequence was, is that it allowed prosecutors to load up sentences such that somebody has to cooperate. You basically have to roll on somebody larger or more interesting to the prosecutors in order to get, in the federal system, what's called a 5K, which is just the sentencing guideline for cooperation. And once the prosecutor tells the judge, okay, this person has cooperated, then it's up to the judge to deviate or depart from whatever the guidelines are. But on the state side, if you start cooperating, Trump cannot pardon Cohen if this guy is cooperating against Cohen, because that pardon, the only extent of it is that, it covers you for federal, but not for state.
Right.
That's the chess move.
So what you're reading as a seasoned professional is normally the plan is to get it from the state to the federal because you're growing it. Essentially, we're trying to get federal, whatever, try to get from the state to the federal. In this particular case, they're keeping it at the state, not trying to grow it into the federal, and that says something to you.
Yeah, it absolutely says something to me, and the timing says something in the that they're closing in on Cohen. And I think I'd mentioned a couple of weeks ago, when you as a lawyer are a subject or a target, there's three kind of grades that you can be in the federal system. You could be somebody who is not a subject, not a target, and you fall into a third category. I know people always call it a person of interest, but I've never called it that. But the idea is that if you're cooperating and then they come in with a search warrant, that's usually 11:58 and you're going to get indicted at midnight. So my read on, remember back on Manafort same thing. They came in, they did the raids on the office in the house, and then boom, within whatever it was, you can do the timeline, he gets indicted. That's the same thing I think you're going to see with Cohen.
I have a theory, and you tell me if this holds water or makes sense in your mind. The left and a lot of the news agencies, which seem to sort of be pretty strong left-leaning, are so over the top with almost everything now that whatever happens to Trump or Cohen or whomever, it's just going to turn into a he said, she said thing. And in a way, I think they're hurting their case for when something with some real meat on the bone comes down the turnpike. So most recently, there was this thing where, you know, some sheriff said to Trump, "What do you think of MS-13? And he was like, "Those guys are animals, and they're worse than animals." And then that got reported as Donald Trump says immigrants are animals, which sort of went in, and everyone went insane. And then he did a thing. Then they sort of modified it to say, you know, Donald Trump said some immigrants were animals. It's on tape. It's pretty clear. He's talking about a ruthless gang. And he called the ruthless gang members who, you know, gang rape and kill people with machetes, he called them animals. There's nothing there. The MSNBCs and the CNNs and New York Times, they all had a field day with it. But there was, it's not even a zero burger, because at least the burger's in the word burger. It is just a zero. It's just, it's, there's nothing, right. There's no case to make. It's like you saying, Charles Manson, that guy's an animal, and then them saying Mark Argus has said everybody with a beard is an animal. So if they keep doing this, what happens when something real comes out with Trump? Because nobody's going to be listening.
I think that there's a lot of truth to that. And, you know, I always call that the little boy who cried wolf syndrome, in that if you're, you know, it's kind of something that you also would teach lawyers, that when you're in, at least in front of a jury, that you generally, in front of the jury, you never try to overstep what the facts are. You try to address what the bad facts are, and you try to embrace the good facts and tell an honest, authentic story. I mean, people always talk about lawyers as slime and this or that, and they do sleazy. And trust me, every day I deal with slimy lawyers. But ultimately, at the end of the day, you're not going to have much success in a courtroom if you're a complete slime ball, because it's going to catch up to you. I mean, it inevitably does. And that same, it's a variation on everything I ever learned. I learned in kindergarten. I always say everything I ever learned, I learned in the context of a trial. If you are inauthentic, or you're playing up a fact that is demonstrably false or overstated, as you just said, it's awfully hard to dial up or go back to the credibility bank and make a withdrawal after that.
You know, it's weird, like weird little things. I saw James Comey at LAX when I left for Cleveland last Thursday. But I remember when he was being interviewed and he said, you know, I went into Trump Towers. I met with Trump. He was sitting there. His tie was too long. It's always too long. And he said to me, and I'm like, "Look, you're hurting whatever's coming out of your mouth next by being sort of catty about how he prepares his ties."
Right.
It's actually right. Better to me if you said he was well-dressed and well-mannered and thought he was a hell of a guy, and then he said this. But if you say he smelled of elderberry wine and his tie was too long, and then he said this, then it's like, I'm not listening, really, because I can tell you don't like the guy.
Right.
And so
right.
With the news agencies, if you're going nuts over Donald Trump and the zero burgers, it's fine. It's good for today. It'll get some clicks and it'll get some looks on your website, and we'll say, "What? Donald Trump called all immigrants animals? What?" It's good for now. But it has to be playing into Trump's hands, because later, if some real shit goes down, he can just go, oh, please, MSNBC, same people who misquote everything I say, the same people that twist all the facts, the same people that blatantly lie about statements, those people are telling you blah, blah, blah. Consider the source.
You know, the interestingly, I don't know if you do this, because I spend quite a bit of time, usually early in the morning or late at night, consuming news, not during the day, but I try to catch up just because I'm interested. And I find now that I look, I mean, obviously there is what you just characterized, and I think the term is clickbait, but you take a look at that, and if I won't lambaste whoever it may be, but there's, you know, probably 30 or 40 sites that I'm just not going to waste the time to read because of this same phenomena. I don't need to be, you know, I always say I don't need to be preached at. I don't need to be lectured. I'd rather just have something that purports to be information conveyed without too much of a bias. I understand everybody's got a bias. Everybody's got an agenda. And part of what you hope is that they try to at least strip it down a little bit to the old expression, calling balls and strikes, which I always find is funny because at least in a judicial context, it's anything but. But you, for consuming information, it's very disconcerting. Don't you find that?
Well, I do. Well, there are certain stories that it's not even about how you report the story. There's certain stories that are just not stories. The Trump saying they're animals, or so-and-so grabbing someone's shoulder on the floor and assaulting them of the Republican convention or whatever it is. It's not a story. There's many things that just aren't stories. So not only the angle that you tell the story, but that you even tell the story at all, because there is no story. Somebody brought up a horrible, vicious street gang. Trump called them animals because he's from New York and he's 70 years old. And that's what folks who are 70 from New York call vicious street gangs. And then we get on with our lives. There was absolutely nothing to see here. And I just think it's going to hurt the credibility big picture. All right. So in your world, Mark Garagus, What is going on that you're able to talk about? I know you have multiple plates spinning.
One of the interesting things is, as we're taping this today, it was just reported, Gary, did the NFL owners have a meeting somewhere today?
Atlanta.
Or where was it?
Atlanta,
yeah, because I, and the rumor has it, I haven't seen it yet, that the supposedly they're going to do some kind of a, what was the, a 15-yard penalty was disclosed, if you
so,
know.
So here's what they're proposing.
15-yard penalty.
So here's what they're proposing. The home team will get to elect whether or not the teams come out onto the field for the national anthem. If that is elected, so the teams will come out for the national anthem, then any person who kneels, that's a 15-yard penalty, presumably on the kickoff, and presumably it is one no matter how many people do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what's interesting to me about this? There's so many ways to solve this issue without abridging First Amendment rights. I mean, number one, standing during the national anthem, by the way, is also political speech. I know this is a hard concept for a certain segment of the population to understand, but if you stand and you either salute or you put your hand over your heart or you do whatever, that's also political speech. You're making a statement. You know, you may be the majority. You may be the most patriotic. You may be feigning to be patriotic, but that's speech also. So what you're saying is we're going to penalize speech we don't like and we're going to reward speech we do like.
You're technically right. It's an interesting dissection of this, one I've never heard before, but you're essentially, look, if you're, I'll do a bridge too far here, but if, Hitler says something and you hold your hand up and go Heil Hitler, you're being respectful to Hitler, but you're also expressing a movement or expressing right. that you condone this or expressing that you're a citizen of this nation and this is happening. And look, I'm not saying First off, I don't, to be clear, and I've been on record, I don't like the whole take a knee thing because I disagree with the premise. I don't think cops are disproportionately.
You and I have discussed this ad nauseum. And you know what? The reason that I get your position is because you understand that it's speech and that you can have an opinion about it as well.
Yes, and so it's all fine, but it's a very interesting reverse engineering of this that I'm sure Sean Hannity would roll his eyes at. But yes, standing up and putting your right hand over your heart is a form of speech when somebody plays the national anthem. And if you kind of think about it, it's kind of interesting. But if you when they take the dolly camera and they go along the sideline, you'll see some people standing there. You'll see some people talking to a coach or something. And then there's the one guy with his hand over his heart and his tears are welling up. And you're like, that guy's a veteran or that guy's right. Dad died in Vietnam or whatever it is. There's different variations. There's gradations of it's not all standing or kneeling. It's different versions.
And all you got to do is go. The only people I swear who don't comprehend this are people who've never gone to a game or something or are already at a 0.20 by the time the national anthem is being played, because I can't think of one I've ever gone to where there wasn't people doing all kinds of things during the period of time when it's being played.
So now if they go to the have their meeting and their rules committee and competition committee and all that kind of stuff and they elect this, what does that mean to you, and is there a counter move to this? Or, obviously,
yeah, there is.
Tell us all about it. Go ahead.
You're gonna pause and do something before I answer.
I'll tell you about LegalZoom. And then I'm curious what this
counter move. How did I know there was something legal coming up?
There's always something legal coming up in your world. Five things business owners can count on from LegalZoom. Reliability. Over 2 million people have used LegalZoom to start their businesses. Experience. They've been helping all types of business owners for over 17 years. Helpful support. They have the right people standing by, ready for your questions, all based in the U.S., Legal advice, well, LegalZoom isn't a law firm, but they have a network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states. No surprises, complete transparency with upfront pricing. Boy, man, upfront pricing, customer reviews, satisfaction guaranteed. It is LegalZoom. Gary.
That's right. Check out LegalZoom.com today to see how they can make life easier for you and your business. And don't forget to enter doubt at checkout to save even more. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. LegalZoom.com.
So your counter to this, if in fact it's decided on that teams can either stay in the locker room or receive a 15-yard penalty if somebody takes a knee on the opposition, or I guess their own team as well, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. How would that work? Well, then both teams should just take a knee, right? And do an offsetting
right.
thing?
Then it's going to be offsetting penalties. I mean, that's what I mean. It's so silly. The whole thing is so silly. And the owners don't know which way to go. They can't figure it out. They're boxed in. They literally are boxed in and can't figure out a solution because they're, I think, paralyzed by the president has done a masterful job of paralyzing them. I mean, he's brought them to the point where they're absolutely pollax.
Well, one of the problems, I believe, if they're the owners. Now, you and I have this same sort of thing with owners and take a knee and sidelines as we have with sort of Kathy Griffin, which is just lay low. It'll let it blow over and it'll go away. But don't have a news conference, you know.
Right.
The owners have.
And certainly pick and choose who you're going to do that news conference with.
Right. The great Gloria Allred. But so I think my feeling is everything is sort of a small flame. And if you just want to feed it, it'll keep consuming. And eventually it might turn into a 5-alarm fire. And if the owners, the coaches, or the whoever's were just sort of neither here nor there, this thing would have just run its course, or a couple of people would kneel and the majority wouldn't, and that would be that. And my kid who likes football would just watch the game, and it wouldn't make a difference to him. But now there's so much energy around it. So they've done a horrible job with this, and now it's something, and it's living and breathing, and now they have to address it. But also, simultaneously, the ratings went down. And because everyone is freaked out, superstitious, and whatever, the ratings went down about the time that the guy started kneeling. And now, I don't think it had anything to do with the kneeling. Either way, they want to fix something that I don't think was broken by kneeling.
I don't think so either. I think that they, and you know, I don't want to reveal what has been disclosed, but I think publicly reported is there's what I consider to be legitimate analysis that has shown it isn't a product of kneeling per se. You can't tie it to that, because that goes both ways. You know, there are those who don't like the way that Kaepernick has been treated, and they won't watch because of that. There's also those who don't like what he did, and so they may take a position there. But what somebody, and these people who are smarter than I, have done is they've analyzed Thursday night football and NFL football and the Sunday night football and the Monday night football and the kind of the spreading out and the contracts and the more games, and also, you know, the moving of two teams into the L.A. market and how that plays it out and things of that nature. So it reminds me kind of when you read medical stories where they say, well, this study studied this and we tried to control for this and we don't know if it's causal, but we're going to say it's correlative. And it's, you know, basically at the end of the day, it's voodoo.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was thinking, I've given you sort of the metaphor before, same thing I would use with like CNN and 24/7 Trump coverage, which is, you know, when NASCAR was king 15 years ago, Fox just kept going, we need more NASCAR and we need a truck series and we need a Saturday night NASCAR and Sunday morning NASCAR. And eventually what happened? It got diluted and people sort of went, enough with the NASCAR. And obviously when one of the only shows out there really kicking ass in the ratings, while all the sitcoms and everything else are sort of, and late night shows and everything else is sort of falling off and having the pie cut into thinner pieces, a few years ago was the NFL. So it's NFL, right? You know, Thursday night, NFL Sunday night, and NFL all the time, and NFL package, and now pre-show and post-show and stuff. So you're putting this huge weight on it, and eventually you're sort of making a little deal with the devil, and that you realize that here's something that really earns out, and now that one donkey, you just keep piling more and more rocks onto the sack that donkey's carrying because it performs for you. And like I said, I feel like CNN is going to feel this when Trump dies of a coronary in 11 weeks, which is like, all of a sudden, they're going to have to go to start talking about natural disasters or something. Like, oh, there was a ferry in the Philippines that overturned. 200 souls perished. Whew, what are we going to do for the next 59 minutes of the show? Like, they're going to be they're not going to be able to talk about anything.
Well, there's a whole lot of interesting nuances to that. I noticed also within the last 24, 48 hours, they announced, I think it was Fox, had given a $1 billion deal, was it to the WWE? And at a certain point, you have to wonder if at least from the NFL standpoint, if they aren't letting these other forms of entertainment pass them by. And part of the reason, you know, I just think that when you take a look at it, the club is filled with a bunch of people who appear to be out of touch. I mean, grossly out of touch. And for those of you who are going to jump on board and say, well, you know, it's your client who's out of touch or this or that. No, what I'm saying is that it's kind of going whichever way the wind blows, so to speak, without without understanding what their product is, without understanding who their people are that are working for them, things of that nature.
What is your prediction for players around the league taking the knee in the 2018 season?
I don't think you're going to see. I think that this so-called players' coalition and this protest to progress initiative by the NFL owners is basically to buy off players and to buy off protests. I don't think it's it doesn't strike me as being legitimate. It looks contrived, and it looks like a way to say, okay, well, we're just going to, instead of having the money spent over here for NFL charities, we'll journal it over to something over here. I don't know that there's, I don't know that it's coming from a idealistic spot. I think it's more of a business calculation. Let's spend some money here on a mutual contribution basis in trade for no more kneeling because that's divisive and whatever else, as opposed to just taking the position that, you may dislike it, I may dislike it. Exactly what you said, which I think is the most honest and frankly, legally correct position, which is I don't approve of it, but I certainly don't approve of abridging the First Amendment as well.
Yeah, and once again, just so everyone's clear, I don't approve of the reason they're kneeling, but I don't mind the kneeling, and I don't mind their right to kneel. But there's also a third part, though, to double back and maybe play devil's advocate, which is when I was walking through the Sherman Oaks Galleria when I was 19 and sort of unemployable and everything was horrible and I wasn't going to college and I was putting in applications at liquor stores and supermarkets and I couldn't find a job. Like the economy was so bad in 1983 that there were literally, you'd go to the home savings and loan in Studio City and you'd look at the sign and it said 3-year T-bill, 19.5%. Like,
yeah, I bought my first condominium, my first piece of property, my first major purchase was the year after that. And I think I was ecstatic that I got I forget what it was. It was some crazy, it was a 12 or 15% loan or whatever it was. It was fixed and it was from the old world savings. I thought that I died and gone to heaven.
It was crazy. I remember at the time, I'll circle back to my, I'll make a note, my hot dog on a stick note. But I remember at the time, I remember thinking, I was dirt poor. I mean, I was destined. I wasn't even poor. I didn't have money. I was beyond poor. I didn't have money. But the richest person I knew was Molly Ringwald, who was on the cover of Time magazine and People magazine. And I was like the biggest star in the world. And I remember looking at the home savings thing. And I remember thinking, Molly Ringwald, I'll bet she has $1 million in the bank. And then I thought, wait a minute. If you have $1 million at home savings and loan in Studio City, she lived around there too. If you had $1 million sitting in that bank and you had a T-bill and you were getting 19% on it, you'd get $190,000 a year. And then I remember thinking, you would be rich on the interest. Like, I remember thinking you could live lavishly on $190,000 a year. What couldn't you buy? What car couldn't you drive? What home couldn't you own? Where couldn't you travel for $190,000 a year? And you could just keep that money in the bank forever and never work again. I remember having that weird fantasy at 19. But anyway, I was destitute, and I went to put in a job at Hot Dog on a Stick, which was at the Sherman Oaks Galleria. It was only chicks who worked there, and they wore outfits that made them look like backup go-go dancers when Sonny and Cher would do like American Bandstand or Pan Am stewardesses from 1969 or something. And I remember saying, can I have a job here? Because at the time, they paid like $6.50 an hour and everyone else paid $3.15. Maybe it's because of the goofy outfits or because you had to churn the lemonade by hand or whatever it was. And they said, no. I mean, they thought it was a joke, but I was serious. I was like, I'll put this stupid outfit on. And if you pay me $6.50 an hour, I'll do anything. Now, getting back to Kaepernick and the NFL, they're getting paid to put the outfit on and make the hot dogs on a stick. What's wrong with the argument where somebody gets to go, these are the rules. You want to kneel when you get back to your apartment, kneel then, but not when you're on the clock.
And, you know, I understand that argument. The problem is that it's if somebody is doing it prior to your work day, you couldn't punish them, number one. Number two, if you're a privy, solely private, to some degree, a greater...
Hold on. Wait a second, Mark. The phone screwed up a little. If you're solely what?
A private entity, but in the NFL, you've got public subsidy. You have public financing of stadiums. You've got public use of funds. And when you have public use of funds, you've got a different calculation.
So, yeah, I've heard that argument.
Kind of like when they say to Planned Parenthood, you know, if you're going to take federal funds, then we're going to put restrictions on you when it comes to abortion, things like that. I remember years ago when certain states, I think Texas was one, Nebraska was one, they weren't complying with national standards for DUI under the influence levels. Like, they weren't reducing it way back when from 0.15 to 0.12 or from 0.12 to 0.10 or 0.10 to 0.08, then you could just withhold highway funds. I mean, that was kind of one of the things if you had a federal standard and go from there. And here, this is a even heightened level of scrutiny because you're talking about the First Amendment constitutional right as opposed to just a statute that prohibits speed over 65 miles per hour, for instance. You know, if somebody said on a highway, well, we're going to let you drive whatever you want, and they say, well, that's fine, you can do whatever you want, but at the same time, we don't have to give you highway funds. I mean, so there's the... You know, you make your bed, you sleep in it. If you're going to use public funds, if you're going to use public money for the stadium that you're in, if you're going to be subsidized by the city for tax incentives and tax breaks, then you have to comply with constitutional and statutory prescriptions.
Good answer. Last question. Speaking of that, it just popped into my head where, yeah, if Texas says we want our DUI number to be 0.20 versus 0.15 versus point, you know, it just keeps trickling down, obviously. And where Texas would do what it want, then federally they go, good, no more, no money, no allocation for filling potholes in Texas. And then,
yeah, well, look what Trump's doing as well. Trump took California, I mean, did the exact same thing with California, with sanctuary city, sanctuary state. With, if you don't, I'm going to deploy the National Guard, and kind of did a standoff, and I'm going to withhold funds. The only time that you're in a better position, and I can't think of a single state that is in this position globally, they are in certain areas, is if your net outflow of tax dollars to Washington from a state exceeds what you're receiving. So if California is sending, you know, X amount of dollars to Washington, D.C., but at the same time they're receiving back 1.25 times that amount from the feds, then it's a tough negotiation to have.
It's a tough side, meaning not...
It's meaning for California, that's one of the reasons I think why Jerry Brown blinked when Trump said, or Trump's policy people said, well, if you don't deploy National Guard to the border, we're going to do this. And we can't do this because even though you're sending a lot of money to us, we're still sending more money back to you.
Right.
And there's discrete funds.
Right. So anybody who, and I don't know, I don't believe there's any sanctuary states or states that have sort of declared themselves sanctuary states that don't need money from the federal government, right?
Correct. I mean, that's, I can't think of one. I'm, hopefully one of your my listeners will correct us, because I'd love to know the answer to it. But I think on for most of the case that you're going to find that the net outflow to the feds usually is, and this is a generalization. I know people don't want to get this granular on it, but there are certain things that you can get away from and other things that you can't, like national defense and entitlement programs and things like that. But on the discretionary piece of the tax revenues, it's almost always going to lean in favor of the feds. In the lean, when I say lean in favor, meaning they're going to have more negotiating.
Well, is this
stronger negotiating?
Then is this going to work? I mean, is the folks that have made the proclamation, California's a sanctuary state, and there's multi-sanctuary states now. Is it all not going to work out big picture because of the feds and the money coming back in and Trump?
No, I think that is, to some degree, it's ultimately going to be symbolic, because whether the courts knock it down or not, and the argument will be that there's a preemption that the feds trump, pun intended, but and it's the same tension that you have right now with marijuana. Everybody says, "Well, I'm going to go invest in the marijuana collective. Marijuana is now legal in the state." Yeah, that's true. But if Jeff Sessions, as the attorney general, says that he's still going to prosecute federally, you can have any state do whatever the hell they want. But if the feds say we're still going to make it a federal crime, great. You may have escaped the noose of the state, but you still got the feds who can trump you.
Yeah, it seems like. Well, it's an interesting bedfellow sort of thing, because I picture Trump and sort of what goes on in his mind, and then I picture, you know, Dianne Feinstein or Jerry Brown or Gavin Newsom or Mayor Garcetti or whomever over here, and I go, there is never going to be some common ground. There will never be a "we'll meet in the middle" or "I think we can all agree on this" sort of comment right. made. If you just picture Trump and you picture, what's her name that's over here? We got Feinstein, you got Nancy Pelosi, you got
Kamala Harris,
you got her. Now you picture Kamala Harris and you picture Trump, and you go, is there ever going to be a point where there's some compromise somewhere in the middle? And I guess the answer is no. It's just all out Muslim. It's the Palestinians and the Israelites, and that's it. This is on, right?
Yeah, I mean, they and it's discouraging at a certain point, because I don't know about you, but I do go home at night and turn on the news for a bit, and I'd like to not be lectured at as much or hear people screaming at each other as much. I'd rather have a reasoned discussion. I'd rather hear somebody's point of view. I'd rather, you know, a lot of times, I don't know about you, but I like to be persuaded of a different point of view. I don't find anything wrong with that. I'd like to be educated. I think that's part of what education is.
Well, I'll tell you, one of my favorite things is finding out something. I'll tell you quickly. I'll tell you political version, and I'll tell you an automotive version. Last Monday, I took my 935 Porsche out to Willow Springs to shoot something with Gay Leno. Gay Leno, that'd be a good character. Hey, whose dick can I suck? Huh?
Gay
suck
Leno
some cock.
Closet.
Gay, now another episode of Gay Leno. Hey, I'm a power bottom. What are you? Who? The brown bandana in the left pocket means bottom. Now another episode of Gay Leno. Yeah, write that down, Gary. Gay Leno. So, Jay Leno. I'm out at Willow Springs with Jay Leno. I got my 935 Porsche, and they painstakingly rebuilt this car and put it back to the specs of how it ran at Le Mans with Paul Newman. And the guy Leno's team brought out is one of the guys who built the car from back in the day. And I asked him something. I said to him something that bugged me forever. I said, every single picture I've seen of this car, when it was at Le Mans, the mirror, the outside driver's mirror on the door was not mounted on the door where it always is. It was mounted way up top, up the pillar, like up toward the roof on the same sort of pillar, but just up, you know, up about 18 inches up in the air. And no one else wore it that way. And it's now back down here. Well, why was it up there at Le Mans? And how come it's not up there now? And blah, blah, blah. And I've never gotten a straight answer. And I've never seen any other car with the mirror mounted up the door, up near the roof. And he said, well, because Paul Newman never drove a nighttime race. He never drove a 24-hour race. And Le Mans is a 24-hour race, and there are people with big-time headlights coming up behind you, like on the Mulsanne Straight at like 110 miles. You know, those Porsche, the big Porsche 962s or whatever, they're doing 255 miles an hour down the Mulsanne Straight. You're in a Porsche Turbo 935. You're doing 205, but you're not – this guy's going 50 miles an hour faster than you. And at night, when it's raining, the glare off that window, off that mirror, when it's parked down at the bottom, just hits you right in the face. And Paul didn't like it. The other guys could deal with it because they were endurance racers and they were used to seeing the guy's headlights hit him in the face there. So Paul slid it up the window, and that's to prevent it from bouncing back into his face. He could still see who was behind him, but it didn't hit him right in the eyes. And I went, all right, that's an answer, and I'm satisfied.
Wow. And There you go.
I just like a satisfying answer. All right, on a upbeat, unlike all the news, we'll go out on a satisfying answer. You guys can go to adamcarolla.com and check out shows. A couple tickets left at the Aladdin Portland Theater, second show June 9th. Chassis, C-H-A-S-S-Y, a lot of really good offerings there for cars and docks and car docks and well beyond. So just go to chassis.com. We got Mark. Mark's got a lot of I got a few tweets, by the way, from some of your hotels. People were sending me pictures.
We've got a lot going on. This is a big weekend. The Capri in Southampton is open. Araya, the restaurant, is open. The pool is open. You couldn't have more fun this weekend than being at the Capri in Southampton, unless you were at the V in Palm Springs and the Elixir there, or downtown at 10E or Engine Company 28, or also at LAX, or at Prova Pizza Bar in Grand Central Station.
I will tell you guys to go to amcarolla.com for all the live shows and everything else, and check out our friend Dennis Miller. Dennis Miller Option. It's on Podcast One and Apple Podcasts as well. And until next time, this is Adam Carolla for Mark Gargis saying mahalo.
Thanks for listening to Reasonable Doubt. Tune in next Saturday for an all-new episode. Corolla Digital.